ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, as we approach the May budget, some recent polls are reflecting an electorate not too enamoured with the Labor government at the moment, nor its efforts to provide relief to the cost of living pressures that many Australians are enduring. A national news poll conducted last week, that's April the 15th to the 18th, gave Labor a 51-49 lead on a two-party preferred basis. That was unchanged from the previous news poll in late March. Mr Albanese's, the Prime Minister's net approval was up 1 point to -6, while Peter Dutton's net approval was steady at -15. Other recent polls, though, from Resolve and Freshwater and Morgan show Labor's popularity deteriorating, and they suggest it's now close to even on a two-party preferred basis. Well, Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers has the job of selling the federal budget. No doubt he's hopeful that that will improve Labor's polling in the aftermath, although the history of budgets hasn't really ever shown much that governments get much of a boost out of it. But still, he's signalled more cost of living support in next month's budget, but only if it was, quote, affordable. Dr. Chalmers has been meeting with G20 counterparts in Washington, and he spoke today about how the budget will take into account downgrades in the outlook for global economies such as Japan, China and the United Kingdom.
The main reason I wanted to provide you with a sense of these downgrades in the UK and Japan and China was to give you a sense of the sort of costs and consequences of this considerable uncertainty and volatility that we're seeing in the global economy.
Joining us again for Nightlife News Breakdown is Hugh Rimmington, National Affairs Editor at 10 News First. Hugh, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil. I'll try not to be as gloomy as the Treasurer.
Yes. Well, I mean, if he thinks he's softening us up, then I'm not sure that people are receptive to the message. But how are you reading these polls? I mean, it's not as perhaps dire as some people are suggesting, although the trend is not good for the government, is it?
It's not good, but it's not catastrophic. And I'm very much reminded of the Howard years when in midterms he often wallowed in negative territory as he went along, and he just had that amazing Howard knack for getting up when he needed to, right when the finish line was there. So the situation for Albanese now is nowhere near as bad as it was for Howard, certainly before the 2001 election, and before the 2004 election as well, when he was up against a bright, shiny Mark Latham, of all things. But, I don't think it is panic stations in the government at the moment, but I think there's a little bit of dismay that things like the changes that they made to the Stage 3 tax cuts haven't given them any lasting lift. Of course, they haven't come in yet. They don't come until July the 1st. But as I say in the show business world, it's a tough crowd out there, and people are feeling pretty miserable on their personal finances, and there's not a lot of love for politicians at the moment.
No, there isn't. And Mr. Albanese must feel chagrined, I imagine, that Mr. Dutton, the opposition, and the opposition have improved in the polls, even though they've been studious about not releasing any new policy. So they're not saying what they'll do, which indicates that the poll results at the moment are a reaction against the government, would you think?
Yeah, look, largely that's true, and that's what you'd expect at this stage. Oppositions don't tend to map out major policy offerings and then give the government a full year to go and beat the hell out of them. There's much more profitable fields to plough by just belting the hell out of the government as much as you can, and Peter Dutton has a skill at that. It's interesting that his nuclear power policies, which there were indications he was going to map that out by the budget, he's now pushed that out for a little distance, so we'll see wherever that lands. But Albanese's still ahead of Dutton as preferred prime minister. Both of them have a negative approval rating. Yeah. But Dutton's is more deeply negative than Albanese. So, again, not catastrophic for either the Prime Minister or Labor. But given how narrow the situation is in the House, you know, they've only got a two-seat majority, they'd be mad to be feeling even remotely complacent at the moment. I don't think they are.
No, it may well be, Hugh, do you think that if there is a minority government at the next election, not just saying there will be, but that the trend of polls might suggest that in fact what we're seeing elsewhere in the electorate is going to come to pass in the federal government, and that is that this strengthened and enlarged crossbench of independents and teals is not going to be a passing phenomenon. It's going to be a phenomenon that may last for quite some years.
Yes, you'd certainly see that there is a possibility for there to be future majority governments. In fact, that's an inevitability at some stage. Mm. But as it currently goes, as part of a long-term trend, the drift away from major party politics, and particularly the sense of close identification with one side of with one major party against the other, that is definitely weakening. And in a whole bunch of electorates, there is potential being seen, using the example of the Teals, for example, and other independents, that there are electorates here and there that are ripe for being picked off. And we've seen the Teals put out a target list of three new electorates that they think they're a fair chance in at the next election. One of those is a Labour electorate, Bean, in ACT. You see the Greens still reckon they're a chance in Wills, for example. That's out of suburban or sort of like a northern suburban seat that's long been a solid one for Labour. It was Bob Hawke's former seat. But that may be a kind of, if you like, a reverse Teal. Hmm. That there's room there to stand up. And Labour's got deep fears of independents turning up, local independents turning up in traditional heartland seats in Western Sydney and snaffling some of them, just as Dai Li did in the seat of Fowler. Mm. So I don't think it anywhere, if you're in a major party, you're really putting your fingers in the dikes, trying to save everything that you can, and winning more seats is much harder because you're not just trying to win them off your traditional opposition or your opponent, but you're in a three or in some cases four-way contest with independents or with Greens. Greens have shown they can take seats off both Labour and the coalition, and it's a bit of a melee out there.
Yeah. Look, just on the budget next month, I mean, the Treasurer, as we just played, sounding pretty gloomy and downbeat. I'm not sure what that's in aid of. But there isn't really going to be much cost of living relief beyond the Stage 3 tax cuts. I mean, that was the government's big move, wasn't it? There's not going to be more in the budget, you wouldn't think.
Well, there'll be stuff, but it won't be major stuff. And the Treasurer was out there again hammering that. So there were two things he really wanted to say today to help shape, you know, he'll say it again and again, I'm sure, before the budget. One is that out there in the world, it's tough out there. And so he's pre-positioning the argument that the budget will do well given the global conditions. He made much of the fact that Japan, the UK and China very significantly is declining in their growth rates. But he didn't make the point that actually the United States is showing more buoyancy than it has for a while. Mm. So it's not universally gloomy around the world. However, the IMF has put global growth at 1.5%. So that's the aggregate of everything on the planet. And that's the lowest it's been since the 1970s. So since the 1970s. So these are, you know, there's a significant global slowdown going on, and that's going to affect things like our exports of major resources, which have been going so well in recent years and have helped us so much to get that budget back into surplus, which is a significant achievement, which Labour is right to claim some credit for, because even though that's to a large degree a windfall, they haven't gone off and blown it. They've banked it away to a substantial degree. But the other message is that the overwhelming cost of relief package has already been announced, and that is the amended stage three tax cuts, which people will start to see in their pay packets from July 1.
That's right. Look, just moving on, the battle with the world's most popular billionaire, in inverted commas, Elon Musk, re-social media. There's been a bit of unity across political lines here. Australia taking on X and Mr. Musk. Federal government and the opposition found common ground here in a push for graphic content, including, for example, of the stabbing massacre at Westfield Bondi Junction, to be taken down off the site, raising the likelihood of legislation to address social media abuses. Mr Musk's been branded an egotistical billionaire by Labor frontbencher Tanya Plibersek. The Prime Minister, Mr Albanese, says removing the videos doesn't affect freedom of expression.
This is about the dangerous implications that can occur when things that are simply not true are replicated and weaponised in order to cause division and, in this case, to promote negative statements and potentially to just inflame what was a very difficult situation.
As I mentioned, the opposition was weighing in too. The Shadow Cabinet Minister, Simon Birmingham, says it's ridiculous too, as Elon Musk has dubbed it, censorship.
And the idea that it is censorship to say that imagery of a terrorist attack, of a stabbing incident, should not be able to be broadcast in an unfiltered way for all to see, children to access and otherwise, is an insulting and offensive argument.
Even the Greens are outraged. This is Sarah Hanson-Young.
It's no wonder that Elon Musk, the narcissistic cowboy, thinks he can just give the middle finger to the Australian government. Because for too long, we've had little to no regulation, we don't tax these guys, and they've been able to do whatever they want for far too long. Well, it's got to come to an end.
Yes, well, the company has hit back, raising concerns about censorship, the jurisdiction of Australian laws and edicts dictating what overseas users can see. It says it hasn't violated its rules around violent content and will fight the order in court. But as I say, there is an injunction which has been granted to the federal agency late today, which orders them to take the matter down. Hugh, do you think Elon Musk is concerned about Australian politicians? Does he care?
There's a number of things in play there. One thing, it's extraordinary if he says that the vivid imagery of the stabbing of the Assyrian bishop in Sydney doesn't violate its rules around violent content. What rules does it have around violent content? Mm. If the repeated use of the stabbing of a man doesn't violate them, that itself would raise some questions. Is Musk worried about them? Musk is a very strange fish. We all know that. He is one of the most brilliant change makers the world has ever seen. He's also, by his own account, has Asperger's. He has told his own advertisers to F themselves. He's an outlandish character. Certainly, Facebook was concerned when Australia swung in behind New Zealand after the Christchurch mosque massacres and started to try to generate a global response which would reach in and put new limits around what could go out on Facebook and across Meta platforms. Because once individual national jurisdictions start doing it, then it becomes immensely difficult to run a global digital instant right in the moment entity like Meta, because it's then subject to, you know, 190-odd jurisdictions, each with their own laws around what they can and can't do. It becomes almost impossible to operate. So they were certainly concerned about it, and they used their leverage, particularly in the United States, so that it never actually got any grip at the G20, despite Scott Morrison initially trying to shop around and get that kind of global support for some new sort of international rules around this sort of stuff. So is Musk worried? I don't know exactly how his brain processes.
But mind you, he has to comply with the law. And, you know, federal government's got an injunction against him, so he's going to have to comply.
Within this jurisdiction, that's right. Mm. He says he's going to appeal against it. Who knows how that's going to go? But it's interesting. There are two separate points that are really being made by Anthony Albanese and others today. To quote back that Anthony Albanese, what he just said there on air, he says this is about the dangerous implications that can occur when things that are not true are replicated and weaponized in order to cause division. Now, for example, with the stabbing of the bishop, the poor bishop, that's not about things that are not true that are being replicated and weaponized. What happened there happened. It was true. So there are really two issues that are going on there. One is the sheer horror of seeing repeated, sometimes by people, well, almost always, if you're going to repeat this stuff, you're doing it through mischief or delight or to cause trouble. And we certainly saw that after the Christchurch mosque massacres. That was, you know, people were using that quite deliberately to try to stir. The fact that he live streamed it to Facebook, his intention was to create notoriety and to create, you know, problems in the world. So this is not what Albanese is referring to when he says that these are things that are not true that are being replicated. These are things that are true. So there's really two issues, and it helps to try to make that distinction between them. There are people saying things that are not true that are getting replicated. For example, during the Bondi Junction stabbings, there were the usual suspects straight away saying, this is an Arab, it's a Muslim killing Jews in a Jewish part of Sydney. Straight away, no verification, out there to try and nail what it is. Someone else famously saying, no, it's a Jewish student who's killing other people. Both of those utterly false, unborne out by events. Channel 7, to its eternal horror and shame, picking up on one of those things and actually naming the Jewish student that had been named by a troublemaker on Twitter and putting it to air on a mainstream media outlet for which they're currently being sued for defamation. But so those are the things that are mischievous and not true being replicated and weaponized. And that's really what Albanese is talking about in that grab. And then there are the other images, which is the imagery, and we heard that from Simon Birmingham, the imagery of a terrorist attack or a stabbing incident that should not be broadcast in an unfiltered way for all to see and for children to access and all those sorts of things. He makes the argument it's not censorship to stop that. And I think the common or garden ordinary citizen would say it is not censorship to stop that. So I think the government and the opposition have got common sense on their side.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Just finally, Hugh Rimmington's with us, National Affairs Editor at 10 News First. This is the Nightlife News Breakdown. Odd story turned up at the weekend. Two prospective candidates for the inner Melbourne federal seat of Higgins, Lucy Bradlow and Bronwyn Bock, reckon they plan to run as joint candidates. They can job share the position of an MP, which is a whole lot of fun, and they got a lot of media coverage for it. But, of course, legally and constitutionally, it doesn't seem to stand up. This is Professor Anne Toomey, constitutional lawyer on the matter.
Once they're sworn in as a member, each of them would have the power to vote in Parliament, and no one could take that power away from them by contract or any other means, so they could both trot into Parliament and vote on issues at the same time. It's all a bit of a fiasco.
Yes, it's one of those ideas. As I say, it got a lot of traction in the media for probably no sensible purpose, did it, Hugh?
Oh, well, I mean, it's a great idea in theory. It falls apart for a whole bunch of reasons. There's nothing.
I'm not even sure it's a great idea. I'm not even sure it's a great idea in theory, is it?
Well, certainly the idea of job sharing and making it possible for particularly working professional women to fully engage in every aspect of a society, it has appeal. There are all kinds of difficulties. There's nothing in the Constitution that I've been able to find that actually forbids it, because, of course, it wasn't contemplated, so they didn't write to forbid it. But there would obviously be difficulties. And, I mean, one of the things about being a politician, and some of those independents have got up and suddenly find themselves in Parliament and they don't have a party structure around them, realise that they might have gone in there because they had one burning issue that got in there. It might be, for example, more action on climate change or whatever, and then find that they've got to actually vote and have an opinion on such an extraordinary range of things. And it could well be that these two women who may be thinking very much of a like mind might have actually differing views on whether, for example, license laws should be changed or something or other. And that could be interesting. And one other little, the mind games you get. But what happens if one of them, heaven forbid, dies in office?
Correct.
Does that mean that the other one just simply takes over? Or are the electors entitled to say, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't so much keen on you, I was keen on the late member, and so therefore my vote, the proper thing now is to have a by-election. All of these things would be complicated. Well, I can't see it happening without a constitutional challenge.
No.
And we don't need another referendum.
We know what happens to those. That's right. And Toomey's point's definitive, really, isn't it? I mean, if you're sworn in as a member of Parliament, you're a member of Parliament. And so the idea that you only half of you has got no constitutional legitimacy. Anyway, look, these exotic ideas are all fun on a slow day, I guess. But I don't think it's going to happen. Hugh Rimmington, always terrific to talk. Thank you.
All the best. Take care.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.